tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm airing an interview I did with Richard Strand, the playwright of Butler, which is currently running at Florida Studio Theater. In this interview, Richard talks not only about his journey to becoming and calling himself and working as a playwright, but also about playwriting itself, about what structure is, about how he learned to be a playwright, and about his current play, Butler, which is so well worth seeing, as you will hear me say over and over in this interview. So hang on. Here comes the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can.
Welcome to The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is about being who you really are. When I say the show is about being who you really are, many people say, well, really, how could I be other than I am? But it is clear to me, as a therapist, that many of us are not who we really are. We're some of the truth of us, but not the whole truth. I see over and over again in my practice that people are in denial for some significant aspects of themselves. So how could this happen? Well, it's not rocket science, and I know that anyone listening also knows the answer. Things happen in our childhood, in our family of origin, in school, and with peers. The culture and religious organizations can give us a message that something about us is not okay. What we think, how we act, how we look, how we smell, how we talk, whether we're right or left-handed, our sexual orientation, our interest in the arts, our not being interested in the arts, whatever it is. Human beings are very flexible, and once we've discovered that this thing is bringing a consequence we don't want, teasing, neglect, punishment, trauma even, well, then we set about to end this thing. But we cannot end who we are. But we can pretend that we are not that. And we get so good at pretending that we actually forget that we are that. And so people can get into their 20s, their 30s, their 50s without remembering significant things about themselves and significant things that have happened to them. This may work very well in your childhood, making you look more like whoever the icon is wants you to look. But because we can't amputate that part of ourselves, it stays there. And later in life, we have the feeling that there's something wrong with us. This is a terrible way to live. So the Lynn Show is about saying, if this happened to you, if this resonates with you, if you suspect that this happened to you, if you have the sense that there's something about you that you can't quite access, it may not be too late to get it back. It is the work of therapy. And if you have any questions about that, you can find me at my website, thelynshow.com, thelynneshow. Click on the email button. Ask me anything. I'll be happy to hear from you and respond. You can also hear all the shows I've ever done, including this one, and all the interviews I've ever done, including this one, which I'm about to air with Richard Strand. Richard is a thoughtful, serious, interesting man with a lot to say about how one goes about becoming oneself, and as I said in the run-up, about playwriting itself. And after the interview, I am going to read Sharon Leslie's review of Butler. But here now is the playwright, Richard Strand. I am here with Richard Strand, the playwright of the current production at Florida Studio Theater, Butler, which I'll say right off, I saw on opening night and was so taken with. It's so wonderful.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
I mean, it grabs you and then it never lets go. And it's interesting, it's hilarious, it's provocative, it's everything a play should be.
I appreciate your saying that.
I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. Mm-hmm. And I only ask one question. Mm-hmm. And it is, given that the art to which you are giving your life is writing, playwriting.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Do you remember the very first time in your life when stories, acting out, telling stories, any of that seemed to call you, interest you?
I think so. I mean, I don't know if I can nail it down to a single thing, but I do know that I do remember specific incidents when I was pretty young that that I now think led me into wanting to write plays. When I was in elementary school, boy, I wish I could get this name right. I'm not positive I can. I think it may be the Robert Johnson Marionettes. But there was a guy who would come to our school either once or twice a year with the marionette show. And I remember being particularly entranced by it, partly because usually when we had an assembly, it was the lights were all on in the auditorium and somebody was standing on the stage. But this is the first time that I was in a theater where they darkened all the lights in the auditorium and the stage was very brightly lit and he had reduced it down to the size of a marionette stage. They were very colorful marionettes and I remember many of the stories and I was entranced by them and it never made me want to be a puppeteer. I wanted to be an actor in the play. I wanted to interact with the marionettes.
How old were you?
I think I saw those as early as first grade, and then it was every year through sixth grade. And I do remember many of the storylines from it to this day. They were. I would like to see those again. I don't. I'm sure. I'm sure the company doesn't exist anymore, but. That was a very early theatrical experience that impressed me a lot, and I was impressed by the writing.
And you said this several times, you remember the stories. So that means every time they came, it was a different story?
Oh, yeah, no, he came in with a different story every time. There were repeated characters. One of them was a dragon named Applesauce. There was a kind of a robot character named G-Wizard. But no, it was a different story every time. And anybody my age who grew up in the Detroit area remembers those characters. They would also appear on television, so it felt sort of like celebrities were coming to my school. But
Okay, so this is the first, and clearly very powerful because, as you say, you remember the stories.
Oh yeah,
right. And what drew you were all these things: the darkness of the room, the color of the marionettes, the wanting to interact. So how come you didn't become an actor?
I wanted to be an actor. I always wanted to be a theater practitioner.
Well, wait a second. Were there other events in your childhood? Did they take you to the theater? Did you go to the movies?
I did not go to the theater very often. I do remember seeing plays fairly young, but it wasn't common. Stratford, Ontario has the Shakespeare Festival, and they would tour shows that would come through Ann Arbor. I remember seeing a production of Midsummer Night's Dream that was done by the Stratford Company.
And how old would you have been?
We came from the elementary school, so...
Oh, so you were still quite young.
Yeah, it's less than 12.
And you remember it?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, I remember. I can remember the set. I know, I know we sat down and watched the entire story, which signals me that they did a significant cutting on it. But I remember Bottom vividly. I found it hilarious when he came out with the donkey head on. I remember that quite well.
Okay, so you were clearly drawn to theatrical events.
Yeah, and I did want to be an actor, and I was a professional actor for a while.
Well, wait a second. Did you join the drama club? Did you do plays in school?
Yeah, I did. There were a few opportunities at my elementary school, which is unusual. One of those opportunities, we had a French teacher for 4th, 5th, and 6th grade that 1 hour of our day was devoted to learning French, and she... had a carte blanche offer of we could always present a skit. If we said we had a skit in mind that we wanted to do, we were always permitted to do that, provided the entire thing was in French. Me and my friend Frank Ritt, we wrote these little playlets in French. She also wrote a version of Peter Pan that was all in French, and I appeared in that. But it really was when I started doing, becoming familiar with important playwrights, that was ninth grade, and there was a woman whose name is Jan Stolarewski, who must have produced, I'm going to say, 5 or 6 one-act plays every year, and then a full-length play at the end of the year. And you couldn't be in it as a 7th grader, you couldn't be in it as an 8th grader. You had to wait till you were in 9th grade to be in in those classes. And I certainly geared up to... as soon as I saw the first one in 7th grade, I certainly wanted to... had in mind, by the time I'm in 9th grade, I'm going to be in those plays.
And you were.
And I was, yeah.
And they were established... One.
Yeah, she did the first play I did. This is hilarious. The first play I did was I played Richard Miller in Ah Wilderness, and again a cutting of it, is not something that is endorsed by the descendants of Eugene O'Neill. But we did. But I became familiar. I read the whole play in order to understand what I was doing in it. I became familiar with. We did. The Torchbearers. She did a lot of 40s and 30s stuff. I became familiar with I Remember Mama. We did The Bat. I was in. There's a play called Mrs. McThing, which most people don't know, but it is written by Mary Chase, who wrote Harvey, and it's a kind of delightful little fantasy piece in the same way that Harvey is. That was...
Okay, so ninth grade, mm-hmm. you're already pursuing this thing to
yeah.
be an actor,
yeah.
right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And high school, same thing, or?
Yes, I was. Yes, there was a drama club, the Theater Guild at Huron High School, and yes, I became. Somebody just reminded me of this. I didn't remember this. She introduced me as somebody who had been the president of the Theater Guild, and I hadn't remembered that I was, but I'm sure she's right about that. So yeah, and the Theater Guild, we understand, is the high school Theater Guild.
I understood. Okay. I understood. Okay, so you're doing, you know, in middle school, high school acting. Mm-hmm. Are you getting any training? I mean, are they...
Yeah, I think so, and most especially from Jan Stolarski. I think she was, I wish she was still alive. I would love to talk to her. She was, I don't think it would even offend her if I said that she was a little bit crazy, but she certainly instilled in me the idea that this thing we were doing was something other than just fun, that it was important in some way. A lot of students had a negative reaction to that. She was, she liked to, let me be fair to those students. She yelled a lot. It always seemed a little oppressive, but it just kind of conveyed in me the idea that, all right, I'm doing something that's important. We got to get this right for some reason that I didn't understand. And she doesn't want me to improvise lines. She wants me to say the lines that the playwright wrote. Okay, I'm starting getting this. And I think that did instill me with a lot of really good habits about theater and an appreciation for theater.
Yeah, it was clearly important to her.
Yeah, absolutely it was.
Yeah, and that's what she communicated.
Yeah.
Right. But not everybody got it.
Right, but I will say this also. She was notorious for being particularly rigid, strict, volatile, but here's the thing that we observed very early on also, which is that the teachers that were in some ways, well certainly were friendlier and I guess then also in some ways more popular, didn't have so many students coming back to visit them, and Jan Stolarski had a lineup of students who would come back and report in and tell them what they were up to and what they were doing. I stayed in touch with her for well into my adult years. Because she had influenced and affected my life.
Yeah, because she was clearly passionate. Mm-hmm. This was not a frivolous thing for her.
Right.
Right. And so if you got that from her, that's a thing of value.
Yeah, absolutely it was.
Yeah. Okay, so then did you major in theater in college?
I did. And my intention was to be an actor. I think most people in theater start off wanting to act. I know there are exceptions to that. My sister's a costume designer, and going on stage is a painful idea to her. But I think most of us start off wanting to be actors.
Well, now this is interesting. Your sister is a costumer, so was there an emphasis on theater in your family?
There was an appreciation for theater, but not in... my parents are not... my dad's an electronic engineer. My mother had been a French teacher, and she was...
I see, so they got two kids in the theater.
Right, there's four of us, and two of us went into the theater.
So it probably confused them.
They attended the theater, they enjoyed the theater. They certainly didn't discourage my...
So when you said I'm going to major in theater, they didn't say, oh no?
Well, you say that the acting thing was never such a popular idea with my mom, but they came to see my shows. They were supportive of that, and let me also say that not so much specifically playwriting, but the idea that I had some ability to write was a thing that my mother did encourage and was particularly interested in. And for I'm going to guess at a number. I'm going to say the first 20 years of my trying to work as a professional playwright, my mother was my editor. And she wouldn't even acknowledge that that is true. But, you know, before I owned a computer, I would give her my rough drafts, and she would type them for me. She was blazing fast. I'm sure she isn't anymore. She is still alive, but I'm sure her fingers don't work that fast. She was a very fast typist, and so she would type my scripts for me. But
and a very generous mother.
absolutely, but it is impossible for her to type something
without fixing it.
Yes, so she functioned as my editor.
Well, we're talking about line editing here. We're not talking about content editing, right?
That's not even true. I mean, she would read them first, and then she'd call me and ask me, what do you got in mind here? I'm not sure that's quite right. She did give me editing remarks, and they were valuable.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you go to college, and you major in theater, and you think you're an actor.
Mm-hmm.
So is it the theater program in which you get actor training?
Or? Yeah, where I started, but I didn't last there very long. That was at Ohio University. They did have an actor training program. You went your first 2 years there. At the end of that 2 years, you auditioned for the actor studio and either got in or did not. If you didn't get in, it would be possible for you to audition again the next year, or you could just finish out your 4 years there and get a degree in general theater instead of a degree with an acting major. And that was what I intended to go through and to audition for the Actors Studio. I'm trying to decide how to phrase this. I guess there's nobody who cares anymore. I got engaged in to get married, and the engagement went poorly, and it seemed like a good idea for me to be in a different town.
Oh.
So
you didn't audition?
I never did. I never auditioned for Actors Studio.
So you just left?
Yeah, I just left. And I went, I don't know, maybe another year and a half or so to Eastern Michigan University, and I didn't finish my degree.
Michigan, you were also majoring.
I was majoring in theater, but there wasn't an actor training program there.
So what were you learning there?
I was doing general theater, and I was auditioning for plays, and I was getting cast in plays.
Yeah, right.
And that's certainly a big part of the education. But I wasn't motivated enough or smart enough to finish my degree.
You weren't smart enough to finish it. Do you mean as in? I don't know, not as in I wasn't intelligent enough, but I wasn't...
I don't think it was that I was not intelligent enough. It is that I wasn't clever enough to know that would be a valuable thing. I did finally end up getting my degree from Eastern Michigan, but that was not until 15 years after I started going to school.
Because you did? Oh. So why would it have been valuable to finish?
I could have... gotten a day job a lot easier if I'd had a degree to go with it. And the job that I currently have teaching at the college, you know, I had to get my MFA before I was going to qualify for the job that I currently have.
Got it.
And in order to get the MFA, I was going to have to first of all get the bachelor's.
BA, right, of course. Mm-hmm. Okay, so far,
mm-hmm.
I haven't heard a word about playwriting. So
well,
what
I'll tell you, it was when I was at Eastern Michigan. One of the things that you could do at Eastern Michigan was... they had a lab theater, a small black box theater, that was open to students to direct projects. And you had to submit the project, and then it had to get approved. But then you pretty much had carte blanche to try it to direct in the theater. And I didn't want to read a bunch of one-act plays to try to find a play that I wanted to direct. So it seemed easier to write one.
So that's yeah, right. Spoken like a playwright. really. I don't think you can find 5 other people in the universe who would say that.
Well, I don't know. It's what worked out for me.
Yeah, right.
But then there was a roadblock, which is that there was a policy against, not so much against doing student scripts, but allowing a student to direct his or her own play.
So wait a second. So your goal was to direct a play?
Goal was to direct a play.
So, well, what an interesting dilemma. Your goal was to direct a play. You didn't want to go
right.
through a bunch of plays. But if you wrote a play, you then couldn't direct
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I didn't know that policy until after.
Until after you wrote the play.
And so there was a particular professor who had that restriction in mind. I waited for him to go on sabbatical, and then I submitted my play, and that was the first time I got a play produced, and I directed it in that studio theater, and my friend Dennis Cockrum was in that play, and I'm still in touch with Dennis. God, that's 35 years later, 40 years later. Okay. Dennis still reads my plays for me.
So this is the first play you wrote.
Mm-hmm.
And did you like it?
I did, and I still like it. I think it's a pretty good play.
I don't mean the play. I mean...
Oh, did I like writing?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it wasn't as difficult as it became. I don't know how many ideas I'd mulled over and rejected, and I don't know why that one fell into place. And it wasn't, it's probably 20 pages long.
So it was like one act?
Yeah, it's a one act play. And I have since then, the next thing I did was to convert it into a full length play, but it came almost too easily, mm-hmm. and lulled me into thinking that, first of all, what I was doing was an easy thing to do, and then it won a couple of national awards, minor national awards, but still national awards. I probably netted, I think it was $700.
Well, this is a big thing for I better write a play.
Right, absolutely. But I don't think I understood. It came so... I didn't understand how extraordinary
it
that was.
And
so that I, my assumption was that, well, I'll just write the full-length version of this, and then I sent that out to 16 different theaters, just waiting for the money to roll in, and instead I got my first 16 rejections, and then that sort of woke me up to, okay, this is a tougher thing to do than I had originally thought it was. And then the actually writing plays... It took me a long time to learn how to do that. The one had come so easily.
Well, yeah, no, but back up, because it didn't dissuade you. You didn't say, "Oh, damn! I thought this was easier. I'll go back to acting."
Well, it slowed me down.
Yeah.
I wrote well, and that first full-length version that I wrote of Harry and Sylvia, I abandoned, and then I took another shot at expanding it. But I've got to count this down now. That would have been in 77 that I wrote the play. And I'm not sure when they did my play at Victory Gardens, but I did eventually get that play produced. But it was at least a few years later.
But again, it didn't, I mean, you're a playwright, so you didn't say, well, that was a mistake, let me go back to acting or something.
No, and it's not like anybody was suggesting that they needed me to act. I wasn't a particularly successful actor.
So we have this period, right? You write this one act, you have all this amazing success. It really is extraordinary.
Yeah, it really is.
And then you think what anyone in your situation would have thought, well, it's no big deal, I can do this.
Yeah.
Right? So you write the long... That doesn't work.
Right.
Then what did you do? I can't imagine that you weren't terribly discouraged.
I was, but I still had this play. There's several places along the way that I think I would have quit if something fortuitous hadn't happened.
What fortuitous happened?
Even at the starting point, if that professor hadn't decided to go on sabbatical, I don't think I would be a playwright now.
Oh, gosh.
And then I did send the script. I must have sent it to a few people, but I don't remember that. But Victory Gardens Theater in Chicago decided to call
me
up.
So you kept sending it out.
I must have.
Because someone did it.
Yeah, Victory Gardens received it. And then I got a nudge at Victory Gardens. My friend, it was Dennis Cockrum again, my buddy. He was doing a play at Victory Gardens as an actor, and he brought up to Dennis Zacek, who runs Victory Gardens, or who ran it. He retired in 2011. But he said to him, you know, my friend wrote this play. I think he sent it to you. You really ought to read it. And Dennis says, well, if he sent it to me, it'll be in that stack over there. And it was in an orange binder. So Dennis could identify it on the bottom of the stack. And when Zacek left the office, he took it off the bottom. But it was still a while before.
But there we have a fortuitous event.
Yeah. Yeah. And it got back to Dennis Zacek wasn't the first one to read it. It was a guy named Steve Carter, and who's a wonderful playwright. But he's the one who encouraged Dennis to do it. And a few places along the way, good things have happened to me, and I've seen Steve Carter write around the corner on them. I got a couple of grants that Steve managed to get for me. And
okay, all right. Okay. Okay, so what were you, about 25, 22, something?
I think I was 24 when I wrote Harry
right,
and Sylvia.
Right. So now we're talking, you're 24, you're 25, you're 26. What do you think you are? I mean, what are you thinking? What are you doing?
It took me a long, I wrote some other plays. I don't think they were as good as Harry and Sylvia, which then the full-length version of which was called Clown. I don't think I'd figured out how to write a play. I don't think I'd figured out how to structure them right.
Did you, so far, have you had any training?
Specifically in playwriting?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm going to say really no. I took a playwriting class that the professor really, he literally quit coming to class halfway through the semester.
Oh, very, very helpful.
So I'm going to say no, I didn't. Can I tell you where I think I got my training?
Of course.
I'm pretty sure I'm right about this. I already said I didn't see a lot of plays when I was young, but I did watch a lot of television,
mm-hmm.
And in particular, I think my taste in writing, I think my understanding of what good writing was, came from when I was 10, when I was 11, when I was really quite young, and I think it was Twilight Zone and the Dick Van Dyke Show. I think, which I attributed to Rod Serling and Carl Reiner, because I didn't know that there were other writers on those shows as well. I didn't understand that it was also Richard Matheson and Charles Beaumont and Persky and Denoff and Marshall and Belson. And
I took a class with Rod Serling right before he
died. Did you really?
Oh, God, yes. He was the most amazing man,
and
the most amazing teacher, and the most generous human being.
And he died so young, and
he was. It was amazing.
It just delights me to hear that.
Yeah, and he would have loved it that he influenced you.
Oh, he absolutely did. I look back even now at, I guess it was just last year. I went through and watched them all again because you can stream now. There's some that are a little silly, but they hold up pretty well.
Well, what's interesting to me is you can't find probably a more diverse, or I don't know what the word is, Twilight Zone and Dick Van Dyke.
Right.
We're not talking.
but here's.
Yes.
Here's what I'm going to say they have in common.
Yes.
Which may sound a little like patting myself on the back, but I think now looking back at it, it's the best writing that was on television at that time.
Yeah.
It absolutely was.
Right.
And I won't mention which ones I think were overrated, but I mean, there's not much wrong with the writing on those two shows.
No. So.
And they are very, here's the other thing, they are very well structured, but that is how you can learn structure.
Talk to me about structure. What does that mean?
It could mean a lot of things, but.
When you use it, what does it mean?
Certainly what I pulled from Twilight Zone of the Dick Van Dyke Show is this idea that you've got a central character with an objective who is trying to push through to the end, who increasingly faces odds against doing it, and that they rise to a climax, and then there is some kind of a resolution to that. And Twilight Zone, in particular, in the half-hour years, man, you can count it down. I mean, they really nail their points, and it is effective writing. Now, you certainly can find other structures that work just as well. But this is the one that captured you. That linear structure, which I think I just—it
was natural for you.
I didn't think of it as structure. I do, but I think it just. I think he laid down my wiring.
I understand. I really do understand. It wasn't conscious.
Right. No, it absolutely wasn't.
Right, and I understand.
And in fact, took me a while looking back at it to figure
see what
out
you did.
Where did I get this from.
And what is it?
Oh, you know what? I think it's Rod Serling, and I think it's Carol Reiner.
And not only that, but what is it? Because it's, I mean, maybe I'm making this up. Maybe this isn't right. But what it sounds like to me is that you integrated it so that it wasn't a conscious process, oh, this is what you should do. That you simply did it.
I think that's right.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like.
But in retrospect, I don't think I can deny that they taught me.
Oh, no, no. I'm not suggesting that they didn't teach it to you, but that you didn't learn it the way you learn it in a textbook.
Right, right. That's right.
You know,
I wouldn't have had a vocabulary.
That's what I'm saying.
I wouldn't have known
that's right.
that it was the climax. I wouldn't have known that
right.
it was
but you,
an inciting incident or a rising
act,
stuff I didn't know anything about.
Right, right. So it's all in retrospect. Mm-hmm. Retrospect that you got it there. Retrospect what it actually even is, how to talk about it. And in... What? No, go ahead.
Here's how deeply it was ingrained in
me.
I wrote a play called The Bug that reviewers quickly identified as being Kafkaesque and would mention, okay, he's writing in these Kafkaesque things. Okay, I had read no Kafka. You know what I had what I was familiar with? Twilight Zone, which is decidedly Kafkaesque. I didn't know what Kafkaesque was.
That's right.
I knew what Rod Serling was.
Right. God bless him. So Butler is a perfect example of this, is it not?
It has certainly got a conventional linear structure, yes.
But what is it that that Butler is trying to do? Is he
what,
just
is that
trying
objective?
To... Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead. How are you going to finish that? I'm curious.
My first thought was, from the beginning, to simply survive in this situation.
Yes, ma'am. But then the thing that drives the play, because I don't think that's enough to drive the play. Here's what drives the play. He's got other things he wants to be doing. He's got this thing in mind that he wants to be that they are not letting him get to. And what he is trying to do specifically with Shepard Mallory, with Kelly, really with Carrie, is he is just trying to make this problem go away in the easiest, fastest way that he can. And everything he tries to make it go away doesn't work.
Wait, stop. Because what I would have said is he's trying to be a good guy.
Well, I think... And I think you can work it that way, and I think an actor can take it that way, and I think the play will work. But I gotta.
But that's not what the playwright had in mind.
Well, and at this point, it even doesn't matter what I had in mind. I've seen it four times now, and there's four really different approaches to it, and I have not seen a bad production of it.
So he's just trying to make it go away. I can see that.
Right, he gets cornered, and here's the thing: what you say about he's just trying to be a good guy, that is. I think of that in terms of that's the thing that trips him up. That's what makes it impossible for him to make it go away.
That's right.
That he's trying to make it go away, and then he goes, oh, you're going to make me do the right thing.
This thing I don't like.
Right.
Right. You're going to make me be somebody I don't want to be.
You're going to make me make a decision that I don't want to make.
Right.
Did the real Butler perceive it that way? I don't have any way of knowing.
How much is this based on the real thing?
There really was a Butler. There really was a Shepard Mallory. He really did come up with that theory as a pretext for not returning slaves to their owners. That is all true. It really happened at Fort Monroe. I don't have, but let's start with this. I have no information that will assure me that Butler ever talked to Shepard Mallory. I don't know that. Neither does anybody else as far as I know. All of the conversations between Shepard Mallory and
are
Butler
yours.
That is conjectural.
It's so wonderful. You have to come and see it.
The kind of person that Shepard Mallory is, I have no way of knowing what kind of person he was.
Right, right, right.
The idea.
But you invented an amazing guy.
I'm pleased to hear you say that. the idea that he was that he had gotten an education that. That's a subject matter I want to address.
Oh, there's one thing.
But I don't have any information that he was.
There is one thing that I would have wanted you to do that you didn't do.
All right.
To explain who taught him or why he... I mean, you had to make it up yourself why he didn't want it, right? Did you want that first, that we had to make it up ourselves? Because I really wanted to know. And at some point, I thought he was going to say it. I thought he was going to confide. But he didn't.
Right, he doesn't.
No, he
and,
doesn't. Right.
You know, and it was a deliberate choice on my part, and I...
I'm sure. So when you...
Here's the important issue to me, is that no matter how he was educated, that would have been extremely dangerous. And also, I wanted to convey the idea that this was something that a northern general would have been completely clueless about. He wouldn't have understood what the danger was,
yes,
why this would...
I see.
But it would be something that he could have been killed for.
Yeah. Okay, so at some point, mm-hmm, you start to have success.
Right, well, the
I mean, really, there are years when you're writing plays, nothing's happening. How are you supporting yourself?
Oh, the same way all playwrights support themselves. I mean, I worked in theater. I was a technical director.
I
did some acting.
But you thought of yourself as a playwright.
I did start to think of myself that way, with not very many plays to demonstrate that with. And it's not until the late 80s that I started to be able to comfortably write plays. I'm going to guess, but I'm going to say it was 1987, maybe it was 86, something, that I wrote 3 plays in 1 year. And they came out really somewhat easily, and that they felt solid, they felt structured, they felt, and then one of those got produced at Actors Theatre Louisville. But again, that just seemed like a remarkable fluke to me. I think if I hadn't gotten the first production at Actors Theatre of Louisville, that might have been the end of it for me also.
I'm fascinated that you went on as long as you did. The first one act is 77?
Yeah.
So it's 10 years of maybe I'm a playwright, I'm going to keep trying,
yeah,
out to
tell,
right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's a very long time,
yeah,
to continue to do something that you are not sure you can do, that you're,
yeah,
not, you know.
That's true, but except that there's a thing about it which isn't true of actors, it isn't true of directors. You can continue to write plays even though nobody's asking you to. So if I just think I'm a playwright, then I can be a playwright. I'm writing a play, whether anybody's producing it or not, is a secondary issue. If I want to be an actor and nobody's hiring me, well, then I'm not really an actor, right?
Well, I have some thoughts on that. But but I wasn't talking about that, that you got acclamation or somebody said, I'll do it. I was thinking about how frustrating it is to continue to write stuff that you don't...
Right.
You don't feel that way about. And to continue to say or behave as though this is something you're going to do. I'm really fascinated by that, whatever that is.
It is... It is helpful to me to write. It helps me to understand things when I'm writing.
Yeah, yeah.
So it isn't useless to me if I write a play that never gets produced. But also, I took years off. There were times when I wasn't writing a play.
Yeah, but I love this idea that there's a benefit, a personal benefit to you, to writing plays.
Well, there absolutely is, and that's even why I wrote Butler, is because I had this situation I knew about that I didn't understand historically. Why would Butler have done this? And I don't have an answer to that question yet, but I could conjecture an answer, and that's helpful to me to work through the issues, to work through what was he confronting and what might be the reason that he would have done something like this, because it's extraordinary that he did it. It clearly was going to jeopardize his career. It clearly was in violation of his orders. Why would he take this kind of a risk? And I don't think that's known or knowable, but I came up with at least what is to me a plausible explanation for that.
I'm just fascinated by this, that this, having discovered that this person did this and that it doesn't make really logical sense, mm-hmm, in order for you to make logical sense out of it, you wrote, first of
something
all, you
that's
wrote
completely fictional.
That's right. It's wonderful.
Something I'm almost certainly wrong about. Yes.
Well, who knows?
Right, exactly.
You know, I mean, maybe you were channeling Butler and, you know, right. Maybe I'm completely wrong about this, but I don't think that is a common process.
I don't know, but I know a bunch of playwrights, and I know that our processes are really different. I'm not sure if I'm unique in this or not. Before Butler, I had not written a play in 12 years. I had a certain amount of success, and then I stopped writing again. I am writing again now. Here's one of the things that I think I've learned about myself, is that I don't want to think about whether or not the play is producible or marketable. It's not going to be useful to me, and there's no point in it, because I'm really bad at knowing whether or not it's going to be marketable
or not. I was just going to say, you can't know.
Well,
No.
I was absolutely convinced that Butler was not marketable. I didn't think anybody would do it. And I told anybody who would listen to me, this one's not going to get produced. It's old-fashioned in a way that people don't write anymore, so it's not going to be interesting to theaters. It's an historical play that theaters are fundamentally not interested in. I was absolutely convinced this play was
going to, well,
that I had to get this out of my system and then go on and write my marketable play. Well, I've never had this much heat about something that I've written. It's going to be my most successful play real soon.
So, what stands out for me is not that, you know, as you say, the playwrights talk about their process and they learn from one another or they don't learn from one another. That wasn't what was in my mind. What was in my mind, well, of course you don't know, the point of the Lynn Show is that too many of us come out of childhood having to deny important aspects of ourselves. Mm-hmm. And that, for me, the goal is to find and be yourself. Mm-hmm. Not that easy to do, but nonetheless doable and a worthy goal. Mm-hmm. So, this thing that you describe, I think it is pretty unique. That doesn't mean you're the only person in the world who has it, but that you honor it, that you do it because it is who you are. You're not saying to yourself, I'm not going to write this play just because I want to understand this mm-hmm. or just because I don't think it'll be marketable. You're not saying any of that. You're saying, this is what I do. Right. This is who I am. I think that's amazing.
Well, and increasingly, I have realized it to be an important part of what I do. It is not helpful for me to not write plays. And I did take 12 years off when I started teaching. Because teaching will consume your life if you allow it to. It takes some effort. It takes some. I need time in a row. I can't do it once a week. I've got to be doing it on a daily basis. I got to find a way in there to do it. I have to strategize how to do it. But it's important to me to figure out how to do that.
How did you learn about Butler?
I was reading a Lincoln biography, and it was the incident at Fort Monroe was mentioned in a footnote. But it fundamentally didn't make sense, and so that was the struggle in writing it. In pursuit of the question, why would he do this? Trying to answer that then yields the play.
Amazing. Okay, so I only have one other question, and it's, having given as much of your life as you have to being a playwright, is there anything you would say about what that's like?
What it's like to be a playwright?
Yeah, for you.
I don't know what the alternative for me would be. It feels like being me.
I think that's a very good place to start.
Okay.
Thank you so much,
you
Richard.
Bet.
It is me. I don't know what the alternative would be. And a little earlier, Richard says, and more I realize this is what I need. It would not be healthy for me not to write plays. And right before that, you hear me commenting on how Richard seems to do what he needs to do, even though it doesn't conform to what most people do, what most people think. He writes a play in order to understand why the character he's writing about is doing what it's doing. As I said, I don't think this is a common way that people approach playwriting. And moreover, he's writing a play he's quite sure will not be produced. The fact that he was wrong about that doesn't alter the fact that when he's doing it, he's not doing it for the motive which most people might. He's doing it for the reason that he must do it. Because it is healthy for him to write a play. Because it is compelling for him to work out why this character would do this thing. Because it is him. And of course, this is the point of the Lynn Show. And why I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. Because when you listen to them, you can hear what it sounds like to be who you really are. To be doing what fits you, what is healthy for you. Even when that doesn't make money, even when that doesn't conform, even when, as Richard says, you don't believe that what you're creating is going to do in the world what other people seem to want to do in the world, people who make their living or their life, and as Richard points out, he's not always made his living as a playwright, but his life is as a playwright. People who make their living or their life with an art are people who have found in at least that area of their life who they are. And it is my hope that when you listen to them, you're asking yourself, is this how I feel about my life? Am I compelled to do the things which are healthy for me, which are me? Am I following my heart, my passion? Or, as Joseph Campbell was fond of saying, following your bliss. Do you know your bliss? Have you seen your bliss lately? So many of us leave our bliss behind in our childhood. If this isn't how you feel about your life, and this is not only true of what you do for a living, this can, of course, be true for how you behave in the world, whether you can stand up for yourself when you need to, whether you think of yourself as someone who gets taken advantage of, someone who doesn't get what they want, someone who can't make correct choices for their life. All of those things are things that human beings come in with. So if you've left some of that behind, please know it may not be too late to get it back. Okay, before I end the show, I'm going to read Sharon Leslie's review of Butler. Sharon agrees with me that this is a play you should not miss, even if only to giggle at Richard's obliviousness to what he had written and how it was going to capture so many of us. So here now, Sharon Leslie's review. It's not often you go to the theater, see a play you know nothing about, and come away wanting to tell everyone to go see it. I say, run to see Butler on the main stage at Florida Studio Theater, playing through February 26th. There is nothing better than a well-written play, well-acted and well-directed. The man in the title is Major General Benjamin Franklin Butler of the Union Army. It is 1861. General Butler is still unpacking his things at Fort Monroe near Washington, D.C., when he is informed that three runaway Negro slaves have arrived. One of them, Shepherd Mallory, has, quote, demanded, unquote, to see the general. Demanded? This word sets off a whole series of exchanges between the four characters in the play. Writing a play based on a moment in history can be tricky. The hardest part is to fill these historical figures with humanity. Strand has made mincemeat of that difficulty while dramatizing an important turning point in the struggle between the states and in the lives of hundreds of thousands of Negroes. Shepherd Mallory challenges, yes, challenges, Butler to find a lawyerly way to twist or apply the words of the law so that runaway slaves during the newly begun Civil War will not have to be returned to their owners. I will not give away the playwright's means of how his characters accomplish that goal, but the twists and turns of events is as riveting as any courtroom drama, and the stakes are high for both men. All the events of the play happen in a one-room set, evocatively designed by Mariah and Isabel Curley Clay. What I love about Jason Cannon's direction of the play is that the action feels natural. The humor in the writing is played with emotional truth rather than for laughs. And there are lots of laughs. It's a very funny play, but I would not call it a comedy. The acting is top-notch. As Butler, Eric Hoffman brings out the character's smarts, love of wordplay, and competitive nature. Yet his Butler is human and humane. As Shepherd Mallory, Shane Taylor brings a fine-tuned physicality to a character that has to carefully dance on a tightrope of contradictory emotions. Taylor masters Mallory's arrogant smartness and fearful humility. As Lieutenant Kelly, Joe Dittmeyer brings a youthful yet earnest manliness to his character as he tries to negotiate the moods of his commander and the uncharted newness of the circumstances. Confederate Major Carey appears in the second act to negotiate the return of the slave Mallory to his owner. As Major Carey, Jim Sorensen displays the distasteful arrogance and condescending of a man who thinks he is right. His character works as a marvelous foil to the arrogance of Mallory and even of Butler. Butler is a terrific choice for FST's 2015-16 season. It has all the elements that make for good theater. Oh, and by the way, you might actually learn something about our country's history while you are watching this thoroughly engaging production. I only have a minute, so I want to say, as always, I hope you got something from this show that you can use. Something that inspired you to ask yourself if you are living the life you were meant to live. Something that tickled you or amused you, or something that you learned that you didn't know about playwriting. Something that will get you out to Florida Studio Theater to see Butler. Something that will bring you back. Because I will be back next week, same time, same station. And as always, I sure hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. I'm going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me simper. I may have gotten